Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Bruce Sterling, who has a book called Tomorrow Now, Envisioning the Next 50 Years. Bruce Sterling is also a major science fiction writer, particularly from the cyberpunk era, and edited the definitive cyberpunk anthology, Mirror Shades, also the author of books like Involution Ocean and Schismatrix. We're going to talk about both cyberpunk, science fiction today, as well as this book. First of all, Bruce, you and I have something in common, which is that we both go back on The Well at least 10 years. The Well was one of the earliest conferences and email addresses. How did you get involved with that?
Well, I used to hang out with Whole Earth people in the back of the Coevolution quarterly days, and it took me a long time to actually meet people like Kevin Kelly and Stuart Brand, but I kind of idolized them from afar for a long time, and their hands-on approach towards social change. It's like, where's the hardware? You know, access to tools and ideas, which was the kind of underwriting philosophy of Whole Earth Catalog and those other publications, had it had a lot of ideological influence over the punk, do-it-yourself epic, and cyberpunk also. I would point out I'm still on The Well. At this very moment, I'm like in the inkwell.view conference, talking about the book on The Well. I've had the same email address for, I guess, 14 years now. And I point that out in my book, what an odd kind of continuity this is. There must be many, many people who have kept the same email address and moved house 10 or 12 times.
Which brings us to Tomorrow Now, which is that this is a book about the future and futurism. And it strikes me in reading this book, as I think back upon the last 15 years or more, could Bruce Sterling have possibly written a book, could anyone have possibly written a book 15 years ago that would actually be in any way accurate about what's happening today 15 years later?
You know, futurism is a dodgy subject, but describing any historical period is tough. You might as well ask yourself the same question about the 17th century. Could I, or Bruce Sterling, or anybody else really write a book about what was going on in the year 1685?
But the point is that if you really can't, and if it's just silly guesswork, then what's the point? I mean, there's got to be somewhere where you can look and say, okay, if Tomorrow Now has any value for us, it's not merely about today, it's also about the future. So 15 years ago, that book, we would assume, would have had some value today. We could look at it and not just sit around and laugh like at National Enquirer's
right.
Predictions for the year.
Guesswork is not necessarily silly. I mean, nobody knows for certain that they'll even wake up in the morning. But still, a future is the only place where you can ever do anything. No action, no thought of yours could ever affect the past in even the slightest way. So you have to have some kind of framework for understanding of where you're going to invest your energies and your thoughts and your feelings and your commitments. And those can only be in the future. And so it's never silly. People personify the future. You know, it's not just some abstract, phony, baloney National Enquirer front page. This is yesterday's tomorrow. The future will be lived. It's experienced through human flesh. History is personified through human actions. You're going to be breathing and exhaling in the year 2005. You're going to be waking up in the morning looking for breakfast unless you're in a coffin.
So let me ask you this. You've done a lot of reading, Bruce Sterling, about this. You've read a lot of science fiction. You've written science fiction. Let's go back 20, 25, 30 years or more. Can we find a book, nonfiction or fiction, that in any way, shape, or form shows the world that we have now and someone who predicted even remotely accurately, other than, say, Philip K. Dick and his paranoid fantasies?
Yeah, I think we could find a few. Philip K. Dick is a guy who's always going to appeal to paranoid people because he's a great paranoid writer. But, if you really want to find some work that is genuinely, freakishly prescient, I would recommend Jules Verne, especially Jules Verne's first book, Paris in the 20th Century, unpublished in his lifetime, but truly an amazingly insightful work. And a graphic artist who was a contemporary of Verne's named Albert Robida. And Albert Robida was basically a graphic satirist, but he wrote or illustrated a number of different works involving life in the 20th century. And this is in the 1860s and 1870s. And, you know, he's satirizing things. What he's doing is he's taking the very classic kind of H.G. Wells approach of finding some trend and tripling it, right? And he wants to push it just to the edge of absurdity, but not so far into the absurd that you can't recognize it. And, you know, it's astounding how much the 20th century does resemble the worst kind of savage satirist attacks of the 19th century. If you're a guy from Albert Robita's bohemian milieu in Paris, and you try to just imagine the worst, the most embarrassing, the sort of most out of control, you know, the most debilitating and sort of hilarious aspects of what's to come, it looks like that. You know, he drew pictures of it, and you can look at them, and they really are like portraits of our own time. He's very little known, but if you're looking for a sense of a guy who has an almost uncanny futurist insight, really, my hat is off to him.
Makes me think that a serious book like Tomorrow Now might prove less prescient than Woody Allen's Sleeper.
Well, you know, Woody Allen has got some stuff going on there. I mean, you know, the odd thing is that social change often is comical to people. You know, I mean, the human condition is comical. And, you know, and many people say that Tomorrow Now is a hilarious book. And many people have talked about science fiction novels of mine as being very satirical, even though it's not clear what, if anything, is being satirized. There's no particular targets for the satire. It's just a sensibility that exaggerates things, but history will do that. I mean, it will take small flaws or just little changes and will bloat them up into great commonplaces.
Tomorrow Now is informed by a few ideas of yours, some of which I agree with, some of which I don't. You divide the world into something you call the New World Order, for want of a better word, I guess, and New World Disorder, which I guess would be the pull of creation and destruction at the same time. In the New World Disorder, there's the chaos of Al-Qaeda. In the New World Order, is George W. Bush the New World Order, or is he both order and disorder?
Well, I think you're cutting him at the wrong angles there. I mean, the New World Order, as I kind of define it in the book, is basically the people with plumbing. It's people who are accomplished technocrats who could do things like urban zoning and world trade rules. But the disorder is not creative destruction. The disorder is actually the collapse of civilization. And there are large areas of the planet as we enter the 21st century that are falling right off the edge of the civilized universe. There are AIDS rates in Africa that may destroy Botswana as a civilized country. There are tyrants who are destroying civil order in Rhodesia. There are civil wars consuming Central Africa. Central Asia does not look at all good. I mean, really, you know, the large sections of the planet are backsliding into mountain bandit-style barbarism. George W. Bush does not have a solution for this. He wants to attack other states. He wants the U.S. to be a state, and war is the health of the state, and he's trying to restore nationalist fervor to the USA to cut off its global underpinnings and support, to shore up his own power base, and then go take out Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. But the difficulty is he doesn't know what to do about Somalia. He doesn't dare go into Somalia. There's nothing to bomb. There's nobody to negotiate with. You want to fix Somalia, nobody picks up the phone.
But on the other hand, there's no oil in Somalia either. I mean, there's goal-oriented behavior with Iraq.
I'm sorry. There are plenty of resources in Argentina, and Argentina's fallen off the edge of the universe. There's tons of oil in Siberia. There's oil all over Russia. There's oil in Central Asia. There's oil in Turkmenistan, and these places are descending into nightmares. I mean, there are lots of places that have oil that are failing to maintain civilization at all. I mean, it's not about mere commercial profiteering. It's really about the human race losing its ability to maintain a quotidian day-to-day life that isn't menaced by barbarism.
I mean, it's easier to say then that it's all about oil or money, but if it's all about power and chaos, then there's almost we're dealing with something elusive, something that we can't get a handle on or find a way to get a handle on.
Well, you know, restoring civil order is a well-established situation. It's just that we lack the guts to do it. I mean, we could go in and install order over Somalia at the point of the bayonet. We could put an MP over every corner and every structure and declare martial law and shoot anybody. And, you know, in the old days of Victorian 19th century empires, they did that instantly. The first chance any tribal government broke down, the British would rush in to restore civilization, and they would just appoint all these imperial suzerains, and there was scarcely a scrap of land anywhere on the dark continent that didn't have these Joseph Conrad overlords showing up there to ship out the ivory and bananas. And we've lost interest in that. We don't care that they've got diamonds, they've got oil, they've got women, they've got guns and drugs. We'll turn them into red light districts. We'll turn them into the cocaine farms. And, you know, our criminal classes will profit over their disorder. It's the dark side of globalization. This is where the split lies in the 21st century. It's not a right-left split. It's not a capitalist-socialist split. It's a technocracy-anarchy split.
Well, the alternative to that almost seems to be, instead of technocracy versus anarchy, technocracy imposing totalitarianism.
Law and order is not totalitarianism. I mean, chaos is actually much more restrictive than law and order. There's very little you can do for yourself as an Afghan woman in a burqa. Your life is very, very limited under those circumstances. The problem, the lack is global civil society. There is none. There's a global civil market. And there's a global civil black market that is huge and growing and thrives mostly in the anarchy. But the lack of a global civil society, the lack of the ability of people of goodwill to focus themselves and restore civilization to areas in extreme decline is coming to catch us up. You know, we can't just neglect them and drop Africa off the side of the boat without paying a terrible price, at the very least, in plagues.
Not to mention global warming and pollution. You go into that in your book Tomorrow Now, toward the end.
Well, that's an interesting discussion. You know, it's little appreciated in many of its aspects. Like, Africa isn't particularly responsible for global warming, but Africa suffers really intensely from global warming, mostly because they don't have any civil defense capacity. You know, if it floods in Mozambique, everything washes away. If it floods in California, it just sort of pools up behind the dams, and L.A. goes off water rationing. It's an odd thing, but as a severe disturbance in the natural order, global warming hits natural environments much harder than it hits industrialized environments.
You do make a statement, the future of activism belongs to sophisticated networks. What kind of activism are we talking here?
Well, you know, I don't think we've seen it yet. You know, I read a lot about it. I mean, the commentary that one sees along this line, people are expecting a global civil movement. If you talk to people in the no global movement, as the Italian likes to call them, you know, the Seattle 99 crowd, the European Social Forum, the closest thing we have to global NGO activism, they're always described in the press as anti-globalists. That if you actually listen to talk to one another, they talk about being in the global movement. You know, and I think they are in the global movement. I think there is a movement which is attempting to stretch across the old national boundaries and form a new globalized civil society. But its difficulty is that it doesn't have any means of legitimation. And it really doesn't have much in the way of a revenue stream. It can't impose taxes on anybody. You know, it tries to. It would like to start, say, a Tobin tax, and then you could put all this money into a pot, and then you could pay yourself some nice global bureaucrats who would go get off the black helicopters in Mogadishu and say, hey, why don't you guys install some plumbing here so the children don't die before the age of 5? Now, that would be an actual improvement. That's a solution. That would be a solution. But, you know, where do they find those resources? Who backs them? How do they set up the structure? What kind of constitution is written for this? Where does the money come from? Who are they civil actors? None of these things are remotely on the table or figured out. We may be decades away from that.
Well, 7 years ago, we might have said that the technocrats running the new economy would be the ones who could fix things, but it turns out that they're not so much new economy as con artists.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think that the new economy is just inherently unstable. You know, it's not unusual to have con artists running your economy. I mean, are you implying that guys who run Mobil or Chevron or these old economy style guys are not somehow more crooked than the guys who run, say, Napster? I mean, gee whiz. I mean, at least Napster never, like, carpet-bombed anybody.
Bruce Sterling, one final question regarding this book, Tomorrow Now. When we think about futurism, putting aside these social issues, we think about things like advanced technology, the opening section of your book about the possible use of microbes, which Michael Crichton in his potboiler Prey kind of offers an alternative solution to that. At least we've got that. That's like the GM Futurama idea. How possible is it that that is a real scenario? Number two, you don't talk about space travel at all. Is that dead?
I actually admire Michael Crichton a lot. I don't think he's like a great novelist or anything, but as a guy who labors in kind of the vineyards of popular culture, Michael Crichton, you know, is a very accomplished guy. I mean, he's a medical doctor. He's a very smart man. This Prey book was obviously written in order to take advantage of particle animation from Industrial Light and Magic. It's like, hey, look at these guys doing this really cool thing in this Twister movie with this particle animation. What kind of book could I write that would be really ideally suited to particle animation special effects? I'll write this thing about nanoparticles. You know, and there's a kind of genius about that. It sort of smacks of Alexandre Dumas, you know? I mean, it's genuine pot boiling, right? It's really, really popular. On the issue of space travel, is it dead? The simple answer, yes, it is.
You're listening to an interview with Bruce Sterling, whose latest book is Tomorrow Now. Let's talk a little about science fiction and the field that you're most often writing in. Cyberpunk burst on the scene, insofar as I know, with a book called Neuromancer by William Gibson and with a film called Blade Runner. Is that how you look at it? Was it something new from the early 80s? Was it a carryover of the new wave from Britain? What is your take on that, Bruce Sterling?
Things are always associated in the popular mind with the biggest bestsellers, and Neuromancer was a bestseller and an award winner, and Blade Runner was a very important movie with extremely interesting set design. I mean, it's little social movements, little literary movements like that are generated by peculiar dynamics among small groups of people. It's what Brian Eno calls genius. It's not a simple act by a genius. I mean, I happen to think that William Gibson is a literary genius. He's one of the brightest and most capable writers I've ever known or hung out with. But he doesn't operate in a vacuum. So, you know, Cyberpunk was a joint effort by about a dozen people and the people that they hung out with.
What do you think were the actual prototypes of Cyberpunk then?
Well, New Wave is definitely a prototype of Cyberpunk, but I also think it owes a very considerable intellectual debt to the Bay Area, to the whole Earth crowd and to the access to tools movement. And also to punk. It owes a really big debt to the punk movement within popular music. The idea that I don't wait to be discovered by the big labels. I'm going to start my own label in my own garage. I'm going to do a lot of independent style fanzine publishing. It doesn't really matter if I, go to the Juilliard School of Music. No, I'm just going to pick up this guitar, a stolen one, and hammer out three chords and just start yelling with kind of the honesty of complete desperation. So, it had theme music, Cyberpunk did. And one of the things that sort of differentiated it from most pop culture movements, say the Gothic movement or other things like that, is that it never had a uniform. People often commented that when you ran into Cyberpunks, they were dressed very modestly, or really what we dressed like mostly, and it continued to this day, as industrial design professors.
It also struck me that it had a certain world view, books set in cyberpunk universes. There's an anarchic underlying theme to this kind of high-tech world, the world that visibly we saw in a movie like Blade Runner, to such a degree that in an interview here on KPFA, Gibson made the comment when he saw Blade Runner, he said it's like somebody had reached inside his brain and pulled something out.
Well, you know, I think there's some brilliant industrial design in Blade Runner, and the guy who did the set design in Blade Runner, whose name unfortunately I can't recall at the moment, was a major Detroit car designer as well, who did a lot of sort of classic futurist stuff. Yeah, I mean, I think that a really effective piece of cinema does show you imagery that looks like something you might have dreamed up. And if it resonates with something unexpressed and unseen before, then, yeah, it becomes popular. It, you know, it crystallizes things visually in the way that poetry crystallizes things verbally. And I'm not a big cinema guy. I don't write screenplays like Gibson does. I mean, Gibson actually likes to go down to Hollywood and hang out with people in the SAG and stuff. He thinks they're really interesting. I don't share that particular interest. I like San Francisco a lot better than Los Angeles. I'd rather hang out with Bay Area Soma geeks from, you know, failing websites than, you know, coke-snorting L.A. dudes in, you know, leisure suits.
The cyberpunk movement produced several key books, some of which were yours. In an aside, I was told by Richard Lupoff that the original title of Schizmatrix was something like Circumsolar, but it had to be changed because he had a book out called Circumpolar. Is that correct?
Well, I like Circumsolar. I've never been good at titles. There were a lot of different Schizmatrix titles. I mean, Schizmatrix is a weird word. It's like neuromancer. It's one of these neologisms. It's sort of, and it's difficult because no one ever knows how to spell it and so forth. Yeah, Circumsolar was one possibility. It doesn't look too much like Lupoff's Circumpolar, but it also looks too much like Circumcision. It's just, you know, it doesn't quite ring right. I don't know. I mean, you throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall, not all of it sticks.
How did you get involved in that movement? Was it through The Well? Was it through the science fiction world? How did Bruce Sterling get to be part of it?
Well, there are all kinds of different little social networks that start up, but I think the real key there was belonging to a writer's workshop in Austin, Turkey City Writer's Workshop, which still exists. It's one of the oldest writer's workshops for science fiction in the U.S., the oldest sort of continuous ones. And, you know, you get a bunch of writers together to talking shop, and they all know people. For a long time, Austin, Texas was the only city in the world that had more than one cyberpunk in it. I mean, actual self-declared working cyberpunk science fiction writers, me and Lewis Shiner. And Lewis and I did a work called the Turkey City Lexicon, which is a collection of critical phrases and sort of concepts for analyzing science fiction. It's kind of a critical handbook, really, that, you know, helped us clarify a lot of our thinking about what science fiction was and what its worst flaws were and what it was supposed to be accomplishing and what the vices were and what the virtues were and so forth. And, you know, he and I used to have very intense literary arguments, sometimes under formal conditions like at writers' workshop meetings, and, you know, sometimes just over a beer. But I think a critical moment there was the day when we had a Turkey City meeting, and I brought a manuscript, a photocopy of one of William Gibson's legendary hand-typed short stories. I brought it to a Turkey City and showed it around. It's like, look, here's this guy in Canada, and I've gotten some fan mail from him, and he seems to be interested in science fiction and what we're doing, and look at this new thing we're doing. And, you know, and I showed it around to my colleagues, most of whom were not really into cyberpunk. I mean, Turkey City's always had a kind of southern-fried gothic cast, really. But Shiner read it and then sort of came over and validated my interest. He says, yeah, I've never heard of this William Gibson guy, but I've never seen anything quite like this before. This is the way forward. We've got to look at what this guy's doing. Give me his address. I want to know about him. I want to know about his friends. I want to know about who's going to publish this. It was Ellen Datlow, for a long time, the editorial queen of the cyberpunk movement. She was running Omni magazine, paid more money than anybody else, and was very friendly toward us and our interests. So, you know, at that point we had three conspirators, a way forward, and a friendly editor. And if you can't make it happen under those circumstances, go home, you know? I mean, just give up.
And at a certain point, as Terry Carr was revving up the Ace Specials, I guess Gibson sent Neuromancer to him, and he was the first person to publish what became kind of a Bible.
Yeah, well, you know, stuff was floating around. I mean, I had two books that had been published by Harlan Ellison, acting more or less as my agent or sponsor. And, you know, Harlan Ellison is my literary mentor, quite frankly. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, was the editor of the Dangerous Visions anthology. He's a major figure in the American branch of the New Wave movement. And he was going out of his way to find young science fiction writers of promise and give them some kind of break. I mean, really try and get them up to speed and clue them in. So, you know, to that extent, yeah, I mean, cyberpunk is an inheritor by direct descent from the New Wave movement. I also had stuff coming out in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. In the early 80s, I had two cover stories from, you know, what eventually became the Schismatrix stuff that, you know, was just in a quite conventional sort of classic SF digest size magazine. And, you know, they were up for awards, and the critics began to assess what we were doing, and cyberpunks have always been critics' darlings. People love us. They love our prose. Sometimes they don't like our politics, but I've never seen anyone say, for instance, that William Gibson is a clumsy writer.
What happened to the movement?
We're real lucky. I mean, nobody died. If you look
right.
at, say, the Beat movement, after five or six years, it's like half of them are face down in a river. You know, the cyberpunk movement was at its most radical and sort of ferocious in 85 or 86. And, you know, and that's a good 15 years ago. Every single one of the people in Mirror Shades, the cyberpunk anthology, made some kind of career, either in science fiction or in computer gaming or in animation writing or in script writing. They all became full-time professionals. And at the time, these were all people with day jobs. None of them were, you know, well-established. They were just, really, people writing on their ironing boards in their spare time. So, you know, it didn't overwhelm the entire planet, but it achieved very considerable success. You know, 15 years ago, I was making this stuff up with a manual typewriter and, you know, a red pencil, and now I'm like an op-ed writer for Wired.
When you're looking at the writers of today or through the 90s, who do you see as the successors? Is there a movement in science fiction?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and, you know, a year ago I would not have said that there was, but I actually believe, yeah, something's going to break. Something's going to happen, and it's going to happen specifically within the cultural context of the Bush administration. I sense a gathering storm within science fiction. Science fiction is suddenly in a situation where it can say things that are politically relevant and that really hurt people's feelings. As George Orwell, a great science fiction writer, once said, in an age of universal deceit, to tell the truth is a revolutionary act. And it's now, I mean, the culture has changed enough since September 11 that I think you can actually say things within science fiction that make people catch their breath.
I had assumed the field was pretty much dead. I'd moved on from it, knowing certain people. Even people like Dan Simmons had abandoned the field. And so there was Neal Stephenson and a few of you guys, and that was about it.
Well, I would recommend Cory Doctorow and Charles Stross. Cory Doctorow has written a book called Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. Cory is he's a electronic civil liberties activist, and I think of him as he's an important figure. You know, I often feel as if I had invented him, but I think that Cory, Charles Stross, Peter Watts, guy who wrote Starfish, some of the new British science fiction people, they don't have a name yet. They don't have a label. And they may never. It may become a wet firecracker. But there is the potential there for a science fiction movement, which is global.
I was blown away by Perdido Street Station by China Mieville.
Yeah, well, I think there's also a lot going on in a group which has recently been given the title New Wave Fabulists. And the New Wave Fabulous would be guys like China Mieville and Karen Joy Fowler and Andy Duncan and people who write literary SF. Kelly Link is somebody who's attracting a lot of literary attention. But this is not science fiction. I mean, it'll be marketed on the same rack, and I know these people as colleagues, but it's just not futurist fiction. It really is fabulism. They're writing in a very magic realist vein.
But even so, it does come back to social comment and it may not be futurism as we've detected it, but, you know, a lot of science fiction never was.
Well, you know, I have had this argument many times with many people, and I know I'm a cyberpunk ideologue, so you're not really talking to the most friendly possible audience for New Wave fabulism here. But I think you are right that John Kessel in particular, who's kind of the gray eminence of the New Wave fabulists, he makes an argument, which is correct, that his kind of metaphorical, very literary, fabulistic writing has a legacy and a series of culture heroes, which is at least as old as that of science fiction. But it is a legitimate subgenre within the field, and it is showing growing vitality.
What about the relationship between the publishing house's attempt to broaden their scope and at the same time narrow the number of books they're publishing so that they're only interested in 15-year-olds? Are we entering a new age of small presses, then, to publish these folks?
I certainly hope so. I mean, Kelly Link's got a small press. Andy Duncan does a lot of small press stuff, and I applaud that. You know, I mean, the self-publishing thing has always been something dear to the cyberpunk heart. I mean, that's the downside of being in a recession, which is what we are, that, you know, frankly, the publishing industry is a basket case right now, and so is the book distribution industry and, you know, the physical underpinnings of the culture industry are in bad shape. It's weird that Disney has to defend Mickey Mouse in the Supreme Court and that they do it by such blatantly illicit means. And, you know, the whole structure of intellectual property is menaced by corrupt fascism on one side and out-of-control copyright piracy on another. It's a tough time to earn a living as an author or a musician or a creative individual of any kind. I mean, to live off IP is menacing and dangerous right now.
Bruce Sterling, do you envision yourself working more with futurism or going back into fiction?
Well, you know, that's a personal question in a funny kind of way. I have a two-book contract, obviously, so, you know, I'm contractually obligated to cough up some sci-fi here. But, you know, this book I've written is a midlife book. I mean, I wrote it when I was in my mid-40s, and I really took some time to sort of back off and do a really broad-scale kind of futurist assessment of where everything I thought all the important trends were going. And I questioned whether I'm ever going to have enough mental energy to do that again. This may be my sort of ultimate futurist statement. At age 58, I don't think I could just read as much stuff as I did in order to assemble this book, nor am I going to have enough imaginative or creative power to synthesize it, even in the sort of awkward form that this thing is synthesized. Writing this book, although I enjoyed it, took a lot out of me. My suspicion is that this is my crowning achievement as a futurist, and you know, I don't know how I'm going to ever force myself to work quite that hard again.
You've been listening to an interview with Bruce Sterling, whose latest book is Tomorrow Now. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.